for Tuesday, April 10, 2007. Committee members, we have a number of bills on the agenda, so the first one of them will come off. So anyone here who's come for the hearing and work session on House Bill 2190, that bill is going to be rolled over till tomorrow's agenda because some amendments that were being prepared are not yet in hand. But we will be taking the rest of the agenda in the order in which it's printed. So we'll be holding public hearings on House Bill 2329, then 2532, then 3371, and then going to work session on House Bill 3119. And we do, for the benefit of those who are later in that agenda, House Bill 2329 has a number of people who are signed up. So judge your schedules accordingly. I expect it could be an hour or more before we would get to the other bills. So I will now open a public hearing on House Bill 2329.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2329, you need to look to the dash for amendments. This has gotten stuff, and this bill relates to the sentencing for repeat property offenders and also the alternative incarceration program.
Very good. And we have Representative Thatcher here, who I think had wanted to present on here's some introductory comments on this, introduce this subject matter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am Kim Thatcher, for the record. I'm representative from Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburgh. And I thank you for giving me an opportunity to address you this morning. I do have another committee I have to scoot to real quick, so I won't take up too much of your time this morning. But thank you for having this hearing this morning and taking the time to listen to some of the concerns that, well, I'm sure others will come up and testify about the alternative incarceration program at the Department of Corrections. As you may know, I started working on reforms to this program last fall when I read some reports in one of my local newspapers and talked to crime victims and district attorneys. I sponsored a package of 8 bills to make AIP more accountable. And for me, this is about truth in sentencing, which is something we really don't have here in Oregon when we start releasing offenders after only serving half their sentences. Several of the components of my bills have been included in the amendments I believe you will be reviewing today, but there are a couple of components in my bills that you won't see in these amendments that I've offered up today, and they will be coming, they're going to be hot off the press and warm when you get them, but Representative Flores will be bringing them in. And the amendments have to do with legislative oversight. I propose legislation to assure that the Department of Corrections isn't just expanding these programs without discussions and permission from lawmakers. And second, performance measurements. I'm a big believer in making sure we're not just creating feel-good programs, but getting something in return for our investment. I know the Department of Corrections has done some preliminary studies, but I would like to see a comprehensive performance audit conducted by an outside agency. And that's why I think as we speak, I'll be bringing you the Dash 5 amendments to add to this bill, which bring an expectation that this program will get a thorough review and have accountability. I'm happy to ask or answer any questions, and my staff will also be on hand if you need anything after I leave. Thanks again.
Very good. Any questions for Representative Thatcher? Thank you very much.
Thank
and
you
we appreciate
much.
Your coming away from your other committee for this. I'd now like to call up the first panel, and we'll be going through a number of panels. And the first one will consist of Joe O'Leary, Max Williams, and John Foote.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. For the record, I'm Joe O'Leary, Senior Policy Advisor to Governor Ted Kulongoski. It is an honor and a pleasure to appear before you today to discuss the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2329. This Dash 4 amendment that is before you represents a very thoughtful and long-discussed consensus between different partners in the criminal justice system. I just note as a preliminary issue, as with any compromise, there are always tensions and there are always rough edges, and I think you'll hear some of those rough edges today. But I encourage you really to focus on the areas of agreement, and I encourage you to focus on the policy behind the discussions of these two topics. One is the alternative incarceration program, and the other is the repeat property offender statute. I wrote three numbers up on the board behind me: 85%, 49%, and 12%. And I want to tell you what those are and why I think that that those numbers are significant to the Dash 4 and this concept and the policy behind this concept. That 85 number, 85% represents the number of repeat property offenders coming to the Department of Corrections who have serious alcohol and drug and or drug addiction problems. 85% of repo offenders with serious drug and alcohol problems. 49%, that second number, is actually the recidivism rate for that population, the repeat property offender population. And then last but not least, 12%. 12% is the number of that population that is currently receiving alcohol and drug treatment. On the board, what those numbers represent. 85% of these folks are addicts. 49% are getting out and re-victimizing, and only 12% are receiving treatment. Those are the numbers that forced this coalition of folks to come together and discuss the repeat property offender statute and discuss the alternative incarceration program. These two conversations really began on two different tracks, and they were led by the two gentlemen on either side of me, Max Williams from the Department of Corrections and John Foote from the Oregon District Attorneys Association. There was conversation first about the alternative incarceration program. This is the program by which, either through a boot camp program or intensive alcohol and drug treatment program, eligible offenders, and under current law that is only offenders for whom the court notes in their order and by statute in open court are eligible, may participate in this program and may earn a sentence reduction. In the course of that conversation, it became clear that these repo offenders, whose crimes are obviously being fueled by their addiction, were not spending a long enough time in DOC custody to get access to the intensive drug and alcohol treatment program provided by the alternative incarceration unit. So what was happening was, and during the course of this conversation, we realized that the people who needed the treatment the most, these repeat property offenders, who were going out and recidivating at a percentage of almost 50%, weren't getting the treatment that would stand the best chance of reducing that recidivism rate and reducing victimization. So that was the easy segue to begin talking about the repeat property offender statute as well. And what the concept before you symbolizes is an enhancement to the repeat property offender statute. Currently, a repeat property offender receives a 13 or 19 month sentence depending on the individual circumstances. And what we learned was that was not enough time in the custody of Department of Corrections to get them in and keep them in to this intensive 6 month treatment program. So the idea here in the Dash 4 is to extend that 13 and 19 month sentence under repo, extend the 13s to 18 months, extend the 19 to 27 months, to add the additional treatment beds that will begin to better address that population. so that, and by when I say treatment beds, by the way, although I can't, I don't want to go into all of the caveats and clarifications that I think in my head, but just so you know, what that means to me in shorthand is evidence-based treatment program by which there are controls and the appropriate best practices so that we know that at least out of that population, we stand a good chance of reducing the likelihood that some of those folks, will, once they get out of custody, which most of them all do, are not going to re-victimize folks. Not only are they not going to re-victimize folks, but they have the hope that they're going to be able to get their lives back together and get control over their addiction and get jobs and become productive members of their family and of society. Not only that, there is hope that they are not going to come back and take up law enforcement resources or district attorney office resources or Department of Corrections resources or judge resources. I also want to tell you that it's really significant. I opened my comments about the consensus and how there's always rough edges around consensus, but I just want to tell you, these two folks next to me here have been involved in this for months, talking about this with other representatives of the Department of Corrections and the District Attorney's Association. We've had Steve Dole from Crime Victims United. We've had Amy Alkonich and Ann Christian from the Oregon Criminal Offense Lawyers Association, Jeff Sugarman from the Partnership for Safety and Justice, Craig Prinz from the Criminal Justice Commission. A lot of diverse viewpoints in the room that have been discussing this and have been working on what is before you in the Dash 4. And I think it's a good policy, because it's going to reduce victimization, it's going to reduce the cost to the system, and it's going to guarantee that the right people get into and can participate in the alternative incarceration program. Two days ago, Lisa Nato, Multnomah County Commissioner, wrote an op-ed in the Oregonian about the need for alcohol and drug treatment access. And she wrote how Oregon ranks, and this is her word, an embarrassing 45th in the nation for access to addiction treatment. And I wanted to note that for your consideration and for the record. I also wanted to note her comment about the effectiveness, the cost effectiveness of drug and alcohol treatment. She wrote that for every dollar invested in treatment, Oregon saves $5.60 in other costs. There's going to be more information about the cost-benefit analysis of this concept, but I want to introduce that issue to you to accentuate this. And the last quote that I want to give you is from a member of your committee, the former chair, Representative Krieger, who wrote an op-ed in August 28th in the Oregonian, following an editorial that about the alternative incarceration program that I think was questionable in its facts. Representative Krieger wrote about how the law currently requires judges to determine whether or not an individual may be even considered eligible for this program, and that that judges should be doing that, and that's appropriate. And Representative Krieger spoke about the importance of this treatment program, the AIP tool, to increase public safety in Oregon, but how fine-tuning may be in order. And this was really in the beginning of the conversations that began back in August of 2006 about AIP. And finally, he wrote that the Department of Corrections and other partners in the criminal justice system, that he would be working with them to focus attention on facts and research and not emotion regarding AIP's effectiveness. And I think that that is why I bring you these numbers, in an effort to show you the policy behind this, and in an effort to to begin this discussion today that I probably can't imagine in my wildest dreams could be resolved if it took us months and months to discuss this and get you the Dash 4 at this point. But I'm really, really happy to have this before you and honored to for the opportunity to discuss it.
Very good. I'll let either Mr. Foote or Mr. Williams go next, in whichever order you choose.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be in front of you today. My name is Max Williams, and I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Corrections. I, too, am pleased to be here after the better part of a year of working with stakeholders, and most particularly the Oregon District Attorneys Association and Mr. Foote, in being able to present the Dash 4 amendments to you today. This has been in a slightly more than 3 years that I've been the director of the Department of Corrections. I came into the department about the time that the IEP program had been expanded by statute in the 2003 legislative session. So that took effect essentially late 2003, and I became the director in January of 2004. And since then, I've had ongoing discussions with district attorneys and others about their concerns regarding AIP. And so it's been a nice opportunity for us in this last year to be able to try to resolve some of those. As most of you know from having worked with many of you both directly as a legislator and as the director of the department, I really am a policy-first person. I believe that good policy ultimately does make good politics. And so I'm here to tell you that what you have in the Dash 4 amendments, in my opinion, is good policy. And I say that knowing that it makes adjustments to the AIP statute as it currently stands. But I believe that we have policy choices that were not originally thought through to the fullest extent that makes some sense to put, for example, a limitation on the AIP sentence reduction to be no more than 24 months and to exclude some specific crimes from access to AIP, because I do think it creates an appropriate balance where people have suffered a death or serious physical injury, that those are issues that ought to be addressed in the statute by way of inclusion. At the same time, I'm a firm believer that once the legislature has weighed in on what those statutory requirements ought to be, that it is important that we recognize the role of the court in making a determination as to whether or not someone is or isn't eligible in inclusion of the program. And once that's done, what the Department of Correction does is evaluates this individual's conduct and their suitability for the program once they're in the department, but doesn't make those initial eligibility determinations. More importantly, however, than the changes to the AIP law that are contained in this bill and in these amendments and that are part of that compromise, I believe is the policy choice before you regarding the repeat property offender statute. It has become abundantly clear to me in the last 3 years that we are turning over a population currently inside the Department of Corrections who, because of their time served locally, by the time they arrive in the department, they often have less than a year remaining on their sentence. And are, before we can stage them up and get them into any kind of meaningful treatment opportunity, they're releasing back into the community. And as a result, we don't prioritize them for treatment because we can't get them in a meaningful way long enough to have that treatment have an impact. And so it would be a waste of our treatment dollars to provide those treatment resources to these individuals. And so they return back to the community with a high rate of recidivism based on the kinds of crimes that they've committed, and untreated, and more likely than not to go out and offend again and create a new victim and go through the process all over again, costing the system literally by the time you move an individual all the way through and through another period of time of incarceration easily into the several hundreds of thousands of dollars. So I believe that that policy choice that you have in front of you today to begin a conversation about what we do with repeat property offenders by lengthening that sentence for both the 13-monthers and the 19-monthers based on the crime that they've committed, by lengthening the 13-month to 18 months and the 19 months to 27 months, what you've done is you've both been proportional in your changes to the sentence, but you've also created an opportunity for the department to intervene and to be able to try to get these people access to treatment. Those who fail and who would not successfully complete the treatment or the 90-day period of transitional leave would fill the balance of their sentence and at the same time lose any of the earned time that they had obtained by participating in the program. So you're actually taking the people who aren't amenable to treatment and have failed, and you're holding them in prison for a longer period of time, thereby enhancing public safety and lowering the likelihood that they'll get right back out and commit another crime simply because you've got them in prison and they're not back in the community. Those, however, who are successful in completing the treatment and successful transitioning back into the community on transitional leave, we have an opportunity to change those people's behaviors and lessen the likelihood that they're going to re-victimize someone when they get back in the community. So what this bill does, what the Dash 4 amendments do on the repeat property offender statute, is it gives you the opportunity to target both the dollars you're currently spending on incarceration on the right people who are committing these crimes and the dollars you're spending on treatment on the right people, and enhancing public safety on both fronts. So it's that issue, in my mind, that far exceeds the policy choices in the AIP program. Those are important, and I don't discount them, but you need to understand currently less than 3% of all offenders who move through the Department of Corrections in a biennium. Less than 3% participate in AIP and receive any benefit in its reduction. So less than 3% of all the offenders that move through the DOC get any benefit from a AIP program currently in a single biennium. This RPO issue, the repeat property offender issue, however, is a much larger issue and a much more significant policy issue as we move forward in an attempt to address these issues to the public and enhance public safety. And I hope that issue is the issue that dominates your thinking on this bill. And again, I have been pleased that we've been able to come up with an agreement around the Dash 4 amendments that can be supported generally, I believe, by all those who will testify in front of you today, at least that we're part of the coalition that attempted to work on this. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions after Mr. Foote has his opportunity to make remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Mr. Foote.
Chairman Pearson, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to come and talk to you today about this bill. I want to first publicly express my appreciation to Director Williams and to Joe O'Leary in the governor's office for their hard work on this. This has been a, like most really challenging compromises, there's been a very vigorous discussion about this. And I appreciate the fact that people have stayed at the table and been willing to talk. I think what we've tried to do here is address some real concerns in the community and some real policy efforts that the Department of Corrections wants to make in this area, and Director Williams has already talked about that a little bit. Fundamentally, the community had three issues that I'd like to identify, and it's simplistic, but three big ones, and the Department of Corrections has two I think they want to address, although I can't speak for them. So this is my take on how we arrived at this situation. First is the Department of Corrections. They want to increase the treatment opportunities for inmates. You've heard the statistics. They're real. I think practicing prosecutors would tell you that these numbers are not a surprise. Number two, they want to reduce the level of recidivism. And obviously, we all want to do that. So those are things they want to address. And I think my conversations with Director Williams and the people in the Department of Corrections, and I had the pleasure and privilege of working in the Department of Corrections for a few years, they folks there are acting in good faith, in my opinion, and they believe in what they're doing. And these ambitions that they want are real. The community, however, has some real concerns as well. And number one is the repeat property crime criminals in our community. They are a real problem. Number two, truth in sentencing. This is something in particular for prosecutors. We care a great deal about this because we've seen the impacts. For those of us who've been around as long as I have, a long time, we know what it was like when we didn't have truth in sentencing. And number three, that violent offenders do not get these time cuts. So this bill, I believe, is a real compromise in those areas. Prosecutors support treatment. We support reduced recidivism. We also feel we have strong responsibilities to our community to deal with crime and to speak honestly about what we see. You're going to hear some of the issues that we identify with AIP. You're going to hear them in a little bit. We don't want to go back and rehash history, but I think it's important folks to have a chance to talk to you about why this compromise was so important and why we're here today. We believe that there will be a cost to this. Obviously, you've seen the estimates, but we honestly believe the long-term benefits to the community will outweigh the cost. This is a good investment, we think. It does two things. It provides treatment to people who are interested in treatment and really want to change their behavior. And be quite honest, and people in the Department of Corrections can tell you this too, there are a lot of people who say they're ready for treatment, but they're not ready. They either know it or they don't know it, but they're not ready. So they don't get the time cut. And the Department of Corrections so far has been very vigorous in their numbers in failing people who are not vigorous. I think the failure rate is 50%. That's a good sign. We want to see that sort of vigorous enforcement continued. And also, this bill provides increased incarceration for people who don't want to change their behavior. And that protects the public. So we're here today to express our support and, again, express our appreciation to our partners who've been willing to come to the table and work out this compromise. We'd be glad to answer any of your questions, and thank you for listening to my comments.
Thank you, Mr. Foote. Are there any questions for members of this panel?
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to comment. I really want to thank you for working together. I know this is, started out kind of far apart in the amount of compromise you've been able to do to try to come up with a workable product. I really appreciate your efforts on that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That 85% number you've got up there, and I want to refer, Mr. Chair, to when you and I were working on the meth package and the fact that we had 5,000 children in foster care. That's the families they were coming out of. And all of this thing with drugs and addiction is connected. The whole dependency package that we've got coming is connected. And I think what you've done in the work is great. And I realize, like you say, when you come to consensus, sometimes isn't quite where you want to go. We've all experienced that as legislators, but probably maybe that's the best legislation when you really get down to it. Got to swallow hard sometimes, but it maybe is best. But the concern I have, and if any one of you could address it, what we're doing here is great. And the parole and probation after they've been released is great. And they've been through a training program, recovery program, that's great. But I still have got a strong feeling that if we don't provide housing and jobs and something beyond that, I think the jobs and housing opportunity would be huge. I think you'd drop that number of recidivism way down below that. And that investment, again, I'm willing to bet you showed an investment of $1 each is $5.60. I think if you could find an incentive for employers to hire some of these people and help train them so they've got a place to go, they're earning their own, and they can say, hey, I can recover, I can become a good, productive citizen again, I think that would be huge. I just wonder if one of you could comment, what you're doing is great, but how do we move towards that maybe in the future?
Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, I really appreciate your comments and about reentry, which is, I think, the issue that you're touching on. 98%, 97% of all offenders in the Department of Corrections are one day going to be released, sooner or later. Mm-hmm. And if, as a system, both at the state level and the county level, we are not preparing those offenders for successful reentry, then we are doing a disservice to public safety. So there are several things that are going on right now, and there are more planned around this issue of reentry. One is in the governor's budget, and I believe it is also in the co-chair's budget, is the funding for about a dozen reentry coordinators. There are already several at DOC, but this will enhance those positions. These are the folks that work with the community corrections individuals in the communities to prepare release plans for inmates so that they are able to be have access to medical benefits and housing and employment and things like that so they can be more successful. I should say treatment to aftercare. The other thing I want to mention is that we have drafted and will be launching within weeks an executive order from the governor that creates a statewide reentry council. whose focus is, by the way, it's going to be made up of agency heads, human services, employment, veterans, every eight state agency and community corrections and community partners, district attorneys, defense council representatives, everyone who might touch a released offender at the end of their sentence, to identify potential barriers that exist in law or administrative rule, barriers to successful reentry, and try to resolve those barriers in a way that first and foremost is in the interest of public safety. So I do want to mention those two points. I think it's extremely important.
Thank you. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Thank you so much to all of you for this hard work that you've done on this issue. I suppose that at some point, maybe this morning, somebody's going to put a price tag on this, and while we're all maybe sitting down, that would be a good thing. But I'm not saying or suggesting that that's not money well spent, and I agree with what Mr. O'Leary said about quoting the article by Commissioner Nadeau that for every dollar spent on treatment, we're saving money in the long run. But I want to pick up on what Representative Krieger was saying about other investments. And the investments that Representative Krieger were talking about were at the release stage. What about investments that we're making as a society before to prevent, for example, if we could get that 85 number down, and whether it be in making sure that we have programs in schools or living wage jobs or something so that we don't have 85% of the people going into the system as addicts. What I don't want to give up that investment, because I think that cuts down not only on the cost to in dollars, but the cost to society as well. So I don't want to lose track of that investment, and if you could address that, that'd be great. Thank you.
Chair Barker, Representative Bonamici, I think I probably speak for all three of us. I don't even need to look and check in when I say that we don't want you to lose sight of those things either. Between Head Start, which is probably, I know Mr. Foote is involved in Fight Crime, Invest in Kids, which is a law enforcement group that lobbies for Head Start funding because it is so front end and so prevention. The data around it is amazing. And I would just submit to you that I don't think those things are mutually exclusive. They shouldn't be mutually exclusive. Obviously, the legislature as a body has to make those policy decisions about the money it has and trade-offs that it can make to make the best decisions for the purposes of public safety, whether it be at the very, very front end or close to the very, very back end with a population that appears to just keep on cycling through and creating more victims.
Can I add, one of the reasons we think that this is a Representative Bonamici, Chair, members of the committee, one of the reasons we think this is a good compromise is it does some of these humane things about treatment. But I don't want to lose sight of the fact that there's another part of this. And it's not, my folks in my business make hard choices. And we have to do hard things, fight to have people locked up. But I firmly believe smart incarceration is an investment, just like these other things are. And in fact, if you look at the most recent study from the Criminal Justice Commission, it confirms that. It has an effect on the crime rate. So I don't want you to think that the only investment here is transition and housing. Incarceration is an investment, and it costs money. But it has an effect. It reduces the crime rate. And we believe the investments here in incarceration, which are the most expensive part of this, are a good investment. They're smart. We're trying to sort out the people who want to change from the people who don't. And you can't go to prison for property crime in Oregon. You got to do it over and over. So we're not dealing with first-time offenders. We're dealing with people who have a pattern of criminal conduct victimizing the community. You're going to hear a little bit of it today. So I don't want to lose sight of that. Incarceration is one of the investments here, and it's an important one, and don't want to sugarcoat that. We've made some investments in Oregon, whether you like policies or not. The crime rate has gone down. So, and that's all good news for Oregonians. And we never really talk about those savings, but they're big. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to go back to the numbers, Joe. You referred to the numbers a little bit, and maybe this question's for you or Max. 85%, is this 85% people that are arrested, not the first time, but that were the population of DOC that we're talking about, are addicted for these they're addicted and they're arrested for these property crimes. Is that correct?
Chair Barker, Representative Cameron, that number represents the repeat property offender. These are the convicted people convicted of either two or four or more under repo who come to DOC. And that we know that number with such precision because DOC screens those individuals coming in and does this assessment for their drug and alcohol needs.
Thank you. This is a series of follow-ups here. And so then the 49% is the recidivism rate measured within how long of a period of time of all those who are repeat property offenders, or is that 49% of the 85%?
Chair Barker, Representative Cameron, that's 49% of all of the repo offenders that go through the Department of Corrections, and that is the definition there for recidivism is the within 3 years new felony conviction.
3 years. And then finally, the 12% number up there, do we track of the repeat property offenders? We're saying that 12% that are addicted to drugs, 12% of that population is getting alcohol and drug treatment. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cameron, the 12% represents the repeat property offenders who have been convicted that are getting treatment inside the Department of Corrections. And that number probably, and I don't have it broken down to that level of detail, but are probably those that are currently getting the longer repeat property offender sentence right now. You can either get a 13-month or, based on certain crimes, a 19-month repeat property offender sentence, and it's probably those with the longer sentence that we've actually got time to put through the process, stage them up, and get them into the program that are getting some access to treatment right now.
Do we have any numbers on the recidivism rate on those 12% that have gone through? Have we been tracking that? Because that's what this policy is doing, is to try to get more people in there. Do we have the recidivism rate of those people as compared to the 49%?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cameron, I don't know that I can specifically tell you the recidivism rate of the 12% who have participated in treatment. I can give you some general rates of the broader individuals. Pretty much to get into the drug and alcohol treatment programs in DOC, you have to have a serious or significant addiction problem to get in. So there are people who are not repeat property offenders who have those addictions that are being included in the program. And we do have preliminary recidivism data on those individuals, and it demonstrated that there's a substantial reduction to our normal recidivism rate by participation in that program. Looking at those early cohorts, you'll remember that recidivism is a lagging indicator. So to the extent you basically have to watch that cohort move through the process and then go 3 years before you have an indication to some degree of what's actually happening there. So we have some preliminary data that shows that the alternative incarceration program is effective. You're going to hear Mr. Prinz here in a few minutes from the Criminal Justice Commission give you some analysis of data that doesn't just rely on sort of our preliminary data, but looks at similar types of programs around the country and actually moderates our numbers down some, discounts our numbers, which we think is wholly appropriate given the fact that we've only got that preliminary data from the very beginning of the program to rely on. So I can't tell you specifically what's happened with these 12% repeat property offenders who have participated in treatment, but I can tell you that generally this group of people who have this level of addiction can be treated, and we can see a substantial reduction in recidivism as a result.
One last point. I think that the whole point of this legislation is to increase that 12% to a larger percentage, and I think it's really important that we've got some handle on the success of those people to really measure this investment and where we're going with it. And then one last question is the AIP. How do we measure the success? How long do we follow those people for to say whether they were successful or not? Is that still 3 years? Do we look at them over 3 years for their recidivism rate?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cameron, yes. We're using similar kinds of measures to measure that population.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So do I understand you correctly that you are or have done studies to measure the effectiveness of the alternative incarceration program?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Flores, yes, the department has done a preliminary study with the initial cohort of individuals who've moved through that program, and that data we have presented to the legislature previously.
Wallace?
Yes.
Thank you. And so as you have done those studies, and maybe it would be helpful if we had a copy of even a summary, if it's an extensive piece to take a look at. But as you're measuring, are you using a random selection of inmates as you from the general population when you compare all inmates in AIP?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Flores, not being a research expert myself, I may not be perfectly clear as I explain how I understand it, but my understanding is what we use is a match pair approach in the research. So we attempt to find people who've committed the similar crime and who essentially have similar attributes and criminal risk factors to the individuals who didn't go through the program, to the individuals who did. And we use that matched pair approach to determine whether or not the program's being successful. In other words, comparing those who participated in the program to those who didn't, who have similar backgrounds, similar risk factors associated with them. So it's not a pure random selection. It's not a double-blind type test, and typically that isn't generally done in most of the research I think that we've evaluated around the country. The models that we're using are similar to the kinds of research models that have been used. For those of you who've seen Mr. Ayos's presentation regarding sort of evidence-based programs and practices, we're following similar sorts of research standards to that effort.
Additional follow-up? Thank you. So do you count inmates who drop out of AIP along the way and never complete the program as failures in your calculations?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Flores, I have to tell you in all honesty, I'm not sure I know specifically. We'd be happy to get you a copy of the research data. I'm not specifically educated around exactly how that research model or that evaluation model worked, but would be pleased to share it with you and the committee, whatever we've prepared on that issue.
Okay. One last follow-up.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So has the Department of Corrections ever had an outside auditor come in and do a performance evaluation or review of the program?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Flores, I don't know that we've had an outside auditor come in and review the program. The program has been evaluated using the CPAI, the Corrections Program Assessment Inventory. And typically how we do that is we don't use our own DOC staff to conduct those sorts of reviews. So there are people both in the community corrections side and from the Oregon Youth Authority who are also trained to perform those CPAI-type inventories of programs. And I know that those programs have been evaluated using the CPAIs, not by DOC staff, but by people from other agencies who've done that review. A CPI inventory is really designed to determine whether or not the program is being operated and delivered within evidence-based parameters and with the degree of fidelity that those kinds of programs typically require. And it's a standardized format that's used all around the country for evaluation of those kinds of programs.
Thank you. I would just like to say thank you to my former colleague and our former staff administrator or counsel and my current DA. So thank you for your good work.
Thank you.
Mr. President, listen in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for bringing forth this, and I know Mr. Leary's talked to me about it. The one thing I would request one of the panel addresses, the thing keeps talking about the program, and then we talk the program is described in 2 ORS 421-505 as the alternate incarceration program, and ORS 421-506 is the intensive program. I guess my question is, do we need to know about those? Because in the staff summary sheet, we talk about the boot camp, and it's still being used. So if you could comment, what is the program? Are those programs evidence-based? And I'm really concerned because I don't see where we're talking about measuring those programs. And I would disagree with my honorable colleague, Representative Cameron, that we're not looking for the number of people trained. We're looking for the number of people who don't repeat or come back. You don't want to measure who goes through the training but who doesn't come back. Also, I'd like to, I have personal experience with sort of a program like this in Deschutes County for youth. And we had a lot of press coverage, and we had to cancel the program because we promised things we couldn't deliver. And the press went after that, and I was actually the chairman of the Commission on Children and Families during that time. And we oversold the program, said, the commissioner's $1 equals $7. It does, but it takes a long time to get that $7 back. So if you can comment on the program, will there be good measurements? And because I think that's what the taxpayers are after. And I do appreciate the district attorney's comment that public safety is a concern. You know, we can't be got to be sure that these people are going through the process.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wisniak, we'd be happy to maybe break down in more detail, recognizing that today is really an informational hearing, break down more detail for you on the specifics of the program. As it's just that if you read the amendments, because it's amending current existing law, it's a little bit confusing to follow which program it's referring to. But we're really talking about the department's alternative incarceration program, and the focus is on the intensive drug and alcohol treatment components of that program, and that would be the area in the RPO portion of the bill that's ultimately being focused on for purposes of expansion as it relates to the repeat property offenders. Again, as far as the evaluations go, no one is more interested than I am in ensuring that these programs are A, both properly evaluated, and that the data that we have with respect to their success is evaluated. Treatment is not an inexpensive component to what these programs are about, and if ultimately the treatment is deemed not to be effective, I'm not any more interested than you or the taxpayer in spending additional resources on it. So we continue to believe that the best way for us to determine that on the front end is to do everything we can to ensure that these programs are being started with an evidence-based design and delivered with the level of fidelity that we believe is required to meet those standards, and then to do the follow-up work after the fact to determine what's actually happening with the offenders who've gone through the program and to track that. The problem with that component, obviously, is that it takes time to follow that, and it's not the kind of thing that you can 12 months later come back and give any reasonable review as to whether or not it has or hasn't been effective. And so when I talk about our preliminary study following that initial cohort, once the expansion took place through that process, I continue to refer to preliminary because I, like you, don't want to be in a position of overselling what this program can accomplish. We believe that it can be successful. We've looked at a myriad of data nationally, and again, Mr. Prinz will talk a little bit about the effect size that they're going to attempt to suggest is an appropriate moderated effect size for purposes of evaluating a cost-benefit analysis. But like you, I don't want the program oversold either. But at the same time, I think you have to pursue the best information you've got, implement it in the most effective way you possibly can, and then watch the results. And in the end, if it is deemed to not be effective and not actually reducing recidivism and enhancing public safety, then we do something different. And you've got my commitment that I won't oppose that effort.
Thank you. Just quickly, then, either Mr. Leary or Director, how would you comment about Dash 5? How do you feel about the Dash 5 amendment?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Wisniak, until I've actually read them, it'd be impossible for me to tell you how I would comment on them. I certainly don't have any objection, and the legislature at any time they want can impose on the department, either directly or through budget note or some other process, any kind of review or a follow-up that's required. Recognizing that any time you're going to do any kind of longitudinal research study, you first have to be willing to acknowledge that that's going to have a time frame. time, and it's not the kind of one biennium time frame turnaround we're talking about. It's multiple biennia out there to get the kind of data you really want to need to have that kind of effective research done. And if you don't want the department doing it, you need to be prepared to have to be paying somebody else to conduct that kind of research.
Thank
but
you.
Beyond that, having not seen the amendments, I really am not in a position to take a position on them.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Just a comment for this panel and anybody else to come. I know almost for a fact that 85% of those people that are in DOC are high school dropouts. And the best thing they could help with, along with what Representative Krieger was saying about job skills, and that's to make sure they all know how to read.
Yes. Chair, members of the committee, can I just add something? I'm sympathetic to Representative Wisnett's comments about trying to understand this. I'll be honest, I read the Dash 4 yesterday, and it was a rough go. Because we had an outline of where Director Williams and the parties all kind of hit the high points of what's going to be in the amendments, and then we had to go find them in the language. And we're still working through that process. You're going to hear from a deputy from Multnomah County, Gary Miyabi, talk about some things that still have to kind of be ironed out. We're going to be glad to talk to you about those details. I want to be as straightforward as I can about this. This is a very delicate balance, this compromise. If we start picking off pieces, the compromise could fall apart. And that's totally your call. But I'm just trying to help you understand. We all work to sort of put pieces together that match the issues that we are trying to address. And we'd like to keep the pieces together while we explain them to you. So we look forward to that process. Yeah,
thank you. And,
Mr. Chair, one
last. We're going to need to move on here pretty quick, please.
Thank you. And I want you to know I'm very, very impressed with the work, and I think that we all would support the goals here. I think an underlying concern for me personally is an accountability mechanism. But that aside, can you just tell me what counts as a repeat offense once someone has moved out of the AFP successfully? Is that an arrest or is it a conviction?
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, if you're talking about recidivism, it's a conviction.
Yes. It is a conviction.
Yes. It's a felony conviction within 3 years of release. So it's a pretty limited description, and I wouldn't encourage us to have that debate today whether that's the right description of recidivism, because that in and of itself leads to a lot of interesting conversations. Obviously, it's a very restrictive one, but it has been the standard for a long time, so it's the one we have.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And as Chair McPherson just was able to get back, said earlier he expected this to last about an hour. We've just had our first panel, so thank you very much. And I'll call the next panel Mr. Berry, Mr. Miyabi, and Mr. Rothstein.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. I'm Brad Berry. I'm the Yamhill County District Attorney. I, too, chair the Legislative Committee for the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I was part of the work group that developed this compromise that has been talked about by Mr.'s Foote, O'Leary, and Director Williams. I spent the time while they were talking marking up my outlines so that I don't take your time repeating things that they talked about. So I'll try and be as quick as I can, recognizing that we're already behind. If I can just make some general comments about the project itself and the work that was done by this work group, we all recognize that there was a need for treatment of offenders in the Department of Corrections, and as often as prosecutors get kind of hammered for going after people and putting them in jail, holding them accountable, we all recognize the need for treatment for most of these offenders. We also, though, noted that there was a need for meaningful accountability for offenders, typically with extensive criminal histories, those that are found find themselves in the Department of Corrections. And I say this last, but it certainly is not lastly, is true for truth in sentencing, both for our communities and the victims of crime. If I can, the one part that I think is important for you to understand when you talk about alternative incarceration programs and how they deal with offenders is to look a little bit at the history of sentencing in the state of Oregon, because I can tell you most people don't understand how we are where we are today. Back in the 80s, truth in sentencing was something that did not exist because of limits with the Department of Corrections. Anytime someone was sent to prison, somebody came out the back door for the same time somebody went in the front door. There just wasn't room. And the sentencing guidelines, which you're probably somewhat familiar, having seen this chart a time or two, I'm going to guess, the sentencing guidelines were adopted in 1989 to achieve several things. First was consistency in sentencing from county to county. Secondly, recognizing limited resources at the Department of Corrections and prognosticating how many beds would be taken by particular offenses. And lastly, and most importantly here, is that it involved truth in sentencing for victims of crime and the public in general. In other words, we recognized that if somebody got sentenced to 18 months, we knew what they were going to do. And as we look at that in today's world, we recognize that most people, well, almost all people sent to the Department of Corrections for a particular sentence will immediately be calculated with an out date of 20% less than that for getting earned time credits, or commonly referred to as good time. Then we enter into the part of those who are eligible for alternative incarceration programs, and with this group that we work, accepting that treatment being the laudable goal that it is, the reward for that is a shortened sentence. As we looked at aiming treatment for those who need it, and in particular, Mr. Miyabi is going to talk about the repeat property offender part of this compromise, we recognize that many, if not almost all of those people, need treatment. But at the same time, I think this compromise recognizes that those who are incarcerated at DOC for repeat property offenses, with the minimum times as have been discussed and will be discussed, recognize that those who choose not to involve themselves in treatment get to spend more time in the Department of Corrections. And I will tell you that these are the individuals who wreak havoc in our communities by committing crime after crime after crime before they're ultimately sent to the Department of Corrections. And then those who choose not to engage in treatment should be there to protect our communities. And I think that this compromise recognizes both of those very delicate balances, the need for treatment and the recognition that there are offenders that we need to keep out of our community, because when they return, they will commit more crimes. And I think I'll just summarize with that and leave it there, and certainly be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Berry. Mr. Mead, is it?
Miyabi, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for listening to this important topic. I want to go back and start with something that Mr. O'Leary said, and not waste your time by repeating what he said, but really couch it in slightly different terms, because what he said was both very, very important and very, very accurate. This is a compromise. It was a negotiated situation. In fact, this version of the bill, -4, I just received yesterday. There's some things in it, frankly, that are different than the last version that I personally saw. So it is a work in progress, and there are some things that perhaps should be adjusted somewhat and changed, or perhaps not. But it is very much a work in progress. The other thing that Mr. O'Leary told you is that repeat property offenders were not spending enough time in Department of Corrections custody in order to get them into the drug treatment program. And he put that in policy terms, why we needed some changes in policy. Mr. Williams said essentially the same thing. Mr. Williams told you that for repeat property offenders, they were getting released before they got meaningful treatment. And he, too, talk to you in terms of policy. What I want to do is just spend a moment and tell you that what they said is just absolutely correct, not only in terms of policy, but what we see in the real world. I'm a senior deputy district attorney with Multnomah County. I supervise the felony property crimes unit. I have about 10 and a half lawyers that work in my unit. All that those lawyers do every day is prosecute property crimes that were committed only in Multnomah County. And it's a huge, huge problem. Now, some of those folks are first-time offenders. And some of those folks, we see them one time, and they go away.
But the vast majority of our crime, at least in our county, and I assume elsewhere in the state of Oregon, is committed by repeat property offenders, by career criminals, by people that do the same crime over and over and over again. So that's what I want to talk to you about, if I may, just for a moment, the repeat property offender law and the changes, some of the changes that are in this bill, and why, as a matter of negotiation and compromise, we ended up with those changes. Some of them I would put almost in terms of housekeeping. For example, one of the things that this bill does is you've got the crime of conviction, the crime that the person is being sentenced for, and whether or not that's the kind of crime that fits under the repeat property offender law. And then, if it does, you next look to the person's criminal record and whether or not he has enough predicate offenses, enough predicate past convictions of repeat property offender type crime. Doesn't matter if he's been convicted of murder. The question is, has he been convicted of things like theft in the first degree, identity theft, forgery in the first degree, those kinds of things. If he has both the current crime of sentencing that qualifies and enough of these predicate prior convictions, not prior arrests, but prior convictions, then he's a repeat property offender and eligible for currently a 13-month sentence usually, or once in a while a 19-month sentence. So one of the changes that we're talking about is adding a few crimes to this list, and you may wonder why. Robbery in the third degree was never on this list, either as a crime of conviction, a crime of sentencing, or as one of these predicate offenses. And frankly, that just it's an oversight, I'm sure. I wasn't here when the law was passed the first time, but it's just got to be an oversight because look at the other things that are on the list, things like theft. If you just take property from someone, that's a repeat property offense. But if you take property and you use force, you beat them up to take it, that's not on the list. So that's one of the things that this bill does is it makes those housekeeping kinds of fixes. It also adds, as crimes of sentencing, repeat property offender crimes, criminal possession of a forged instrument in the first degree, felony, and fraudulent use of a credit card. Again, those were left off the crimes that you could be sentenced as a repeat property offender the first go-round. I have no idea why, but given how similar they are to forgery, theft, identity theft, it only makes sense that we would add those. So that's one change, housekeeping change. Now, more significant changes. As I think Mr. O'Leary told you, again, quite accurately, quite correctly, it increases the current 13-month sentences to 19-month sentences, and or 18 months, excuse me, and it increases the current 19-month sentences to 27-month sentences. Why do we need that? We absolutely, absolutely, very desperately need that for exactly why Mr. O'Leary and Mr. Williams told you. What happens every day in my courthouse is that the deputy DAs in my unit will be sentencing someone for his 5th, 6th, 7th, a couple of weeks ago it was his 30th-something property crime, and the defendant is facing a 13-month sentence. And here's how the argument goes. The deputy DA pounds on the table and says he's a repeat property offender. The legislature has said the presumptive sentence is 13 months. Judge, give him the 13 months. The defense attorney, doing his or her job to try and get the best result for his or her client, says, no, don't send him to prison. My poor client has a drug problem. That's probably true. He's been using meth. He lost his job. He got tied up in the meth world. He started stealing people's IDs and forging checks. And if you send him to the 13 months at the Department of Corrections, that's not enough time to get him into AIP. He won't get the drug treatment he needs. And so he'll be right back out in just a few months, because he's already got several months in, credit for time served, and he'll be right back out forging checks. So we need community-based treatment. The judge is in a horrible position. The legislature says the presumptive sentence is prison, 13 months, and yet the judge knows, he or she knows, that that's not enough time to get into AIP. We need you to fix that. And that's what this bill does. Because now, if we increase those 13-month sentences to 18 months, there will be enough time for the people, as Mr. Williams and Mr. O'Leary and Mr. Foote have told you, that really want that treatment to get that treatment. And for the others, and quite frankly, there are a large number of the others who talk about treatment, but I will spend 10 seconds telling you they use that as a facade, and they will flunk out of the program, and they are the career criminals, and we need to incapacitate them. And that's what the Criminal Justice Commission for the State of Oregon in their report to the legislature in January of this year said. That report told all of us that recent research indicates that incarceration significantly affects crime rates. And it does it in two ways, incapacitation and deterrence. And that's what this bill does, is it puts together RIPO and AIP, and instead of these two good, basically good programs, basically good ideas working against each other, they'll work together. And that's why we're asking you to pass this. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Rothstein.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Howard Rothstein. I am a software developer by profession and a volunteer policy analyst for Crime Victims United. I'm here to speak today about amendments to HB 2329, and these amendments are still subject to further revision. So my comments are based on where these amendments are headed as far as we can tell. We support the proposed amendments to HB 2329, which address reforming the alternative incarceration program and modifying sentencing for repeat property offenders. We believe that AIP needs to be reformed on the grounds of justice for victims, truth in sentencing, and the credibility of the criminal justice system on which the safety of all Oregonians depends. Mr. Berry spoke about the indeterminate sentencing system that was used in our state in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. This was a system in which long sentences were pronounced in court, but were almost never served, and often a small fraction of the sentence was served. This phony sentencing system, combined with an unwillingness to fund prisons, led to a meltdown of our criminal justice system. This is an article from the Salem Statesman Journal from February 21, 1988. It quotes the director of the Department of Corrections, Michael Franke. And the article says, "Director Michael Franke admitted that the state's correction system had lost its credibility with law-abiding residents and with criminals themselves. Quote, we don't have a deterrent to the guys on the street. We have lost control of it. That was the state of our criminal justice system in 1989. We feel that the sentencing reduction component of the alternative incarceration program is a step back towards the repudiated indeterminate sentencing system. I wrote in my written testimony that we are philosophically opposed to AIP, but I want to correct that. We're philosophically opposed to the sentence reduction component of AIP. We support the treatment component of AIP, provided that it is subject to rigorous evaluation. You will hear later from two of our members, Debbie and Ron Jensen, about a crime that took their daughter Robin's life. The jury convicted the person of hit and run and found an aggravating factor of extreme indifference to the value of human life. The driver was sentenced to 24 months in prison, but through AIP was released in 9 months. That's the type of thing that erodes credibility. Just this morning in the Oregonian, I came upon an article. It's entitled Fugitive Watch. The fugitive's name is Rocky Orr. His criminal history includes first-degree sodomy, and first-degree sex abuse for assaulting a 9-year-old. He is a designated predatory sex offender. He was convicted in November of 2004 of third-degree rape and burglary and was sentenced to 6 years and 8 months in prison in November of 2004. Now he's a fugitive. It's not because he escaped from prison. It's because we released him from prison. I don't know if he was part of AIP, but I can't think of any other way that a person sentenced to almost 7 years in 2004 could be a fugitive in 2007. This is the kind of thing that erodes the credibility of our criminal justice system. Now, I'm going to abbreviate my comments in the interest of time because I know we're running behind, but I want to touch on one other topic, and that is the evaluation of the success of AIP. The current evaluations, let me just back up and say that any evaluation of any program, whether it's a corrections program or a medical treatment program, relies on comparing two groups of people, a treatment group and a control group. If those two groups are not comparable, you cannot draw any conclusion from the data. The current evaluation of AIP does not use the gold standard of random selection, but instead uses a process of statistical matching, or matched pairs, as Director Williams characterized it, in which someone in the treatment group is paired with someone that has similar characteristics. But the characteristics that they match are things like age, race, and criminal history. That leaves out three of the four big risk factors, as identified by Dr. Edward Latessa. The three big risk factors that it leaves out are personality, associates, and antisocial attitudes. I don't think those things can be matched. So the statistical twin that we're using as a comparison group, I don't have confidence that it's a true comparison group, that it's truly comparable. Any study that evaluates AIP or any other program should be based on the highest methodological rigorous standards. It should be capable not only of providing ammunition for supporters of the program, but it should be capable of changing the mind of an open-minded skeptic. That's what I am. I'm an open-minded skeptic. I would like to believe that the success rates reported in the preliminary reports are accurate. That would be great news. I would be happy to believe it. But before I believe it, I want to see a rigorous study that uses random selection, which is the gold standard.
Mr. Rodstein, I'm afraid we're running short on time, and your time is in effect cutting through into the time
and you know,
your
I was just at the point where okay. I said I will skip the rest of my testimony.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you.
Committee members, any questions for any members of this panel? Thank you very much, gentlemen. Next, we'll hear from Ron and Debbie Jensen and Mike Winhausen. Please do understand that we have several more bills yet set in, on today's calendar, and 10:30 is when we have to be on the floor. And so if we could keep your remarks as brief as they can be, that would be very helpful. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the members of the committee. Good morning. My name is Ron Jensen, and my wife and Debbie are here from Benton County, too. Support the AIP program and amendments on especially concerning the deaths and injury in crime in this state. My wife Debbie will speak on our behalf.
Thank you, Chairman McPherson and the committee members for allowing us to speak today, as we do have a special interest in regarding the reforms of the alternative incarceration program. Some of you are aware, on August 11, 2004, a hit-and-run driver, Amy Stack, killed our 18-year-old daughter, Robin Jensen, as she rode her bike home from work. She was struck from behind by Stack and was left to die in a ditch just a mile from our home. Crime was committed, Stack was finally convicted by a jury of her peers of felony hit and run with an aggravating factor of extreme indifference to human life. Stack was sentenced to a minuscule time of 24 months and served less than 9 months for a crime, and then was allowed to return home to her home state of Oklahoma. Stack received a slap on the wrist for the hit-and-run death of our daughter and was entitled to good time and other sentence reduction programs. Stack was told during the sentencing from Judge Locke Williams that she wasn't a criminal, and yet he sent her off to prison. Stack killed our daughter with extreme indifference to the value of human life and then awarded an opportunity to engage in the AIP program offered through the Department of Corrections and served only less than 9 months. This made the insignificant speck of justice that we received for Robin's death nearly pointless. We, on the other hand, will have to live our lives without our daughter Robin. For our family, this was an outrage and insult to our daughter, who was killed by someone who displayed no remorse for the crime and hid away to protect herself. We feel we have, and as well as other families, fallen victim to the effects of the AIP program. We believe Stack, as well as others who commit an appalling crime as a fatal hit and run, should have no extra privileges and should certainly not be allowed to participate in the alternative incarceration program and should serve their true sentence. The AIP program must and needs to be fixed, and it needs to be changed for the victims of crime and not just to benefit the criminal and the state to save money. If our daughter was here with us, Robin, I know that she would want to make sure that the criminals needed to be accountable for what they had done in society, and the current AIP program does not allow that. We strongly support these AIP reforms, and we urge you to pass House Bill 2329 as amended and to guard the safety of all law-abiding citizens. We also support in Section 8, which states offenders are not eligible to move to another state as part of the interstate compact during transition leave portion of their sentence. We thank you, Chairman McPherson, and the committee in allowing us to speak today.
Thank you, Mr. and Mrs. Jensen. We're sorry for your loss, and we appreciate your coming out to share your story.
Thank you.
Mr. Windhausen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Michael Windhausen. I formerly was a prosecutor in Benton County, now a prosecutor in Linn County. I was the prosecutor on the case involving Amy Stack and the death of Robin Jensen. I'm here primarily to speak about the amendments to the AIP program and its eligibilities. I want to begin by making the comment that with regard to our alternative incarceration programs, although it was indicated that there has to be a statement on the record regarding eligibility for those programs, the fact of the matter is that statement on the record is obligatory under the statute. It's presumed that the court will allow alternative incarceration programs for virtually every single person convicted in this state, short of Measure 11 crimes and crimes involving under 137.635, which would be the Denny Smith's bill, these presumptive sentences. In this particular case, as Ms. Jensen stated, the defendant in this case killed Robin Jensen in August of 2004. She made great pains in concealing her crime, and in the estimation of our office,
attempting to hide the fact that she was in fact intoxicated at the time of the incident. Her efforts to cover up that aspect of her crime were successful, and we were unable to even indict the defendant for a more serious offense of manslaughter, for which she was, in my estimation, guilty. That being said, when the defendant was ultimately convicted, and I think it is important to note that the jury found not only that the defendant was guilty of that crime, but also that it was committed under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life, and that the jury felt that the defendant deserved an aggravated sentence beyond that on the guidelines. The defendant had no prior criminal history, although she did have a prior incident of driving under the influence of intoxicants in Oklahoma. Presumably, that was dismissed pursuant to some sort of a diversion program. She was an eye on the guidelines, the presumptive sentence, because the crime seriousness was 8. This was after the change in the hit-and-run law. She was subject to a 16- to 18-month prison sentence. By virtue of the fact that the jury found this incident to be one committed under extreme indifference to the value of human life, the state requested that the defendant be required to serve a 36-month prison sentence. That was the maximum sentence we could achieve, even with the aggravating factor. The court chose not to impose that sentence, and certainly that's within the court's purview and province, and imposed a 24-month sentence. We urged the court not to allow alternative incarceration programs. One of the reasons behind that was the fact that we had been told that alternative incarceration programs were purposes of treatment, and there was, at least based on the facts, we had no treatment issue in this case. It was simply she had struck Robin Jensen and left the scene.
Mr. Winhausen, we've got a number of other witnesses we need to hear from on this bill, so I'm wondering if you could
certainly
come to a conclusion soon.
And I appreciate your indulgence. The amendments that have been proposed, the value of those is that heretofore the alternative incarceration programs have basically been a presumption. Under the new amendments, it requires the court to at least go through some measure of analysis before allowing someone eligibility in the programs. That seems to be a very important aspect of this, and certainly one that I personally support, and certainly the DA's Association supports as well. In addition, it does prevent specifically, with regard to this case, persons who commit violent crimes and specifically cause the death in a hit-and-run incident from being precluded, and that is also something that we support. I appreciate your time.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Winhausen. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our next panel will be Mike Wilson and Craig Prinz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Craig Prinz. I'm the Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission. I'm going to be very brief and speak very quickly because I know you want to get through these. The first thing I wanted to say is for the Jensen family, and for the committee to address on page 5 of the Dash 4 Amendments, lines 29 and 30, I want to make it clear that the defendant, Ms. Stack, was convicted of 811705 on line 30. That is felony hit and run where there's serious physical injury or death. So under this Dash 4 amendment, such a person would not be eligible for AIP and would be disqualified. The other thing that I wanted to address regarding the case that was mentioned is exactly what the prosecutor of that case mentioned, which is this is a hard amendment to go through. Sentencing is a difficult thing to walk through if you're not familiar with it. But on page 4, section 2, this is the part that removes the presumption that a defendant is eligible for AIP. You can see bracketed language on line 28. That removes that presumption so that under current law, the state would have to bear the burden of proving a substantial and compelling reason to avoid AIP. This would take that language out, and then Section 3 lines out what the judge would do to evaluate whether someone should be eligible. I'm going to turn it over to Mike Wilson. I wanted to address those issues, and then he's going to very quickly give you the cost-benefit analysis that we did on the AIP program.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Mike Wilson with the Criminal Justice Commission, and I hopefully also will be brief here. I wanted to just go over quickly the cost-benefit model that we've developed at the Criminal Justice Commission and how that can be applied to AIP. And this particular case, I'll be looking at the drug and alcohol component of that. I think there should be a handout there in front of you. The cost-benefit model that we have used is that which has been used by the Washington State Institute of Public Policy. We've basically taken their model and applied Oregon numbers, cost numbers to this. In most cases, they're available. There's, for the cost of arrests, we didn't have data for Oregon for that, so we used Washington numbers. We've also included the impacts on victims, and this is from a national study that has been done, so we can figure out the cost of these different components of the criminal justice system. So if you look on the next slide there, I put an example of if one assault occurs, there's a lot of different costs that are going to be associated with that. So any assault occurs, there's going to be cost to victims. There may or may not be taxpayer costs, whether or not if that crime isn't reported, there's not going to be any cost for an arrest or conviction. But we can figure out on average when an assault occurs, or really any crime, we can figure out on average what are the costs to victims, and then what are the costs to taxpayers in terms of arrest, conviction. If they're convicted, they go to prison or probation, then they're there for a certain length of time. So we can calculate we have data to figure out what those costs would be. So once we can figure out those costs, we can estimate the benefit of avoiding a crime and what the benefit is to the taxpayers if we're able to avoid some crimes. The next slide, just briefly going to touch on effect size, which is what we've talked about a little bit today with basically, an effect size is just looking at the way of to measure the reduction in recidivism from a program. So any program is going to have some sort of effect size. That if the program is completely ineffective, that effect size might be zero, meaning it doesn't reduce recidivism at all. Or in some rare cases, it's actually positive, meaning the program increases recidivism. But generally, we're hoping for a negative effect size, an effect size that reduces recidivism, reduces the future criminal behavior. And we estimated this using the Department of Corrections preliminary estimates and also looking at Steve Osa's work from the Washington State Institute of Public Policy. And we estimated for AIP, for the drug and alcohol treatment portion, an effect size of around 14%. And we took that effect size and put it through this model to figure out how many crimes were avoided, how many convictions were avoided. And in doing that, if you look on the next slide, we can get a benefit estimated out of that. And so as what I've done is I've looked at the taxpayer benefits from crimes that were avoided and looked at victim benefits from crimes that were avoided. If you look in the little table there, in year one, you'll see those numbers are negative. And you've got, if you add them all up, it's a negative $10,000 in benefits, meaning that the people that went into AIP in year one cost victims more and cost taxpayers more. And the reason for that is that the people who were in AIP on average, and in this scenario, get out about 6 to 7 months earlier. So in that first year, they have 12 full months to be committing new crimes and be convicted of new crimes, where the people that aren't in AIP only have 5 or 6 months to be committing new crimes. So in year one, you see that there's actually a cost to taxpayers and to victims for people that are in AIP. Years 2, 3, 4, and 5, those costs are more than made up for. And if you look at the total, this is for any one individual that completes AIP. There's a savings of about $1,000 to the taxpayer in terms of avoided crime, and there's a savings of about $1,300 to victims in terms of avoided crime. So you get a grand total there of $2,300. And the next slide, I wanted to include the cost of this program. And you look at the cost of AIP, it's about $6,800 per completer. And you compare that to the benefits you get from the program. You get the 6.5 months or so off the sentence is a benefit to taxpayers of about $70,000. And then you have the reduced crime, so there's fewer crimes over those 5 years, which gives another taxpayer benefit of about $1,000 in that same $1,200-$1,300 range for the benefit to the victims. If your total savings are, the total cost is about $6,800, and the total savings is $19,000, about $400. So on the final slide, I just wanted to break that down. So if you invest under this effect size, if you invest $1 in AIP, it's estimated to return roughly $2.86 in taxpayer and victim benefits. And I've also compared that in a previous study we did at the Criminal Justice Commission. We looked at investing $1 and what effect that had on reduced crimes. And if you invested $1 in incarceration, what the effect was on reducing crimes. That's about a dollar-to-dollar ratio. So if you invest $1 in incarceration, you get around a dollar back in terms of avoided crime through taxpayer and victim benefits. And that was all I had.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Flores?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not specifically a question, but I don't know if you would be able to answer it, but we heard earlier that in the Oregonian piece today or yesterday, there was a comment from Lisa Nato that for every dollar investment, there's $5.60 estimated return, and I'm just wondering the divergence between your dollar and 286.
Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, Lisa Nato, I know her well and I've worked with her. She's referring to the Mike Finnegan study that NPC Research did in Portland on the effectiveness of drug treatment, really not just in an incarceration program. And that was a study that I think we all are familiar with, or Mike is familiar with, I'm familiar with. This is an evaluation of the specifics of the AIP program and the repeat property offender program. As we talked, prison is expensive, and it has a benefit. And so I know that when a lot of those studies that Ms. Nato and Mike Finnegan looked at, they're in more the drug court context, where you can do a drug court or some type of other drug treatment for first-time offenders and things like that. It's people who have not even gotten into the criminal justice system, and so that's why there's a divergence on those. Incidentally, I wanted to address one of your other questions. When we looked at, you had mentioned, does this include failures? We included failures in the costs, but we did not try to factor a benefit to those who go through part of it and fail. But most research says there is a benefit to those who fail out of a treatment program, that the recidivism is still reduced. So I think we took a conservative look at that. So I hope that answers your question. And if you'd like, I can get you the NPC study that Ms. Nato is referring to. And for Representative Wisnett, I would address too the same thing with Deschutes. We discounted the effect size dramatically from the first preliminary studies that Director Williams did, because of that same thing that we've learned from Steve Ose. You want to, I would, you know, when we're talking about a 14% effect size in reducing that, I'm confident that this program, when funded, can attain that, and I would rather undersell and discount. I think we've learned in all of these studies to be very wary and to constantly evaluate it, and so I wanted to address both those comments. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we're on a camera. We have several people here from.
So I understand. I understand, question. Mr. Chair. But real quick, the effect size of 14%. Earlier I asked the question about the recidivism of the 12% or whatever that number is. I can't see the board anymore. We're not. This study doesn't focus on exactly that population of people with repeat property crimes. Is that correct? This is a general population study.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, that's correct. It's a blend. It's a looking at the AIP's preliminary studies and then Steve Ose's studies nationally, rigorous studies of in corrections.
Thank you. That's, I just wanted.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Our next panel is Jeff Sugarman and Emil Konich.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Sugarman. I'm with the Partnership for Safety and Justice. This may be the only time I ever testify before this committee and say that the Partnership for Safety and Justice could support a bill that increases sentences. So while I don't mean to confuse everybody, I do come here today to ask you to take a close look at this bill. We're neutral on the bill right now, but it's a bill we'd very much like to support. While we have a long-standing opposition to only increasing sentences and thus the cost and size of our prison system, we recognize that this bill provides the state with a significant increase in the number of drug treatment beds under the alternative incarceration program. To us, it's a question of balance. Today, 50% of the people who need drug and alcohol treatment, education training, and cognitive behavior retraining in our prison system are receiving no treatment whatsoever. The DOC recently reported to the Public Safety Subcommittee that it's spending $8.9 million of its $1.1 billion budget on programs in prison designed to reduce recidivism. The good news is that almost all of that is going to solid evidence-based programs. The bad news is that's less than 1% of the DOC budget. If done right, House Bill 2329 can actually begin to restore some of that balance through the increase in the AIP beds. From our research, the AIP program is a program that is working to turn lives around. In the budget test, in the testimony before the Public Safety Subcommittee on the DOC budget, there was compelling testimony, including a member of Representative Barker's district, from people who have gone through the AIP program and turned their lives around successfully. In my written testimony, I've outlined some changes that we believe that will make this legislation more balanced and more revenue neutral. And we should take note that the savings in this legislation will come from the increased investment in treatment beds, while the costs will come from the increased length of sentence. And only if we balance those two successfully can we make this legislation work. I can't help but think of the meth package last session and the hard work that was done in this committee to provide a balanced approach that offered treatment and sentence enhancements and came out with a bill that is really making a difference in Oregon today. We're headed in the right direction with this legislation, but it still needs some work from this committee, and we appreciate all the work that's been done on the bill to date. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Sugarman. Ms. Alkonich.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, my name is Amy Alkonich. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. At this time, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers is neutral on this bill. As Mr. Sugarman stated, we would like to be able to come and support this bill as work on it progresses. We've been lucky enough to be involved in some of the meetings, to be able to sit down with the parties who have worked incredibly hard on getting this bill to the place that it is now, and we appreciate them including us and taking our feedback into consideration at so sincerely as we feel like they've done. This bill was originally introduced to us as a means of fixing the problem of low-level repo offenders and their inability to get into the AIP treatment programs. As a criminal defense attorney, having the opportunity to work with Mr. Miyabi, who you heard testify, I know that this is a real problem. And for people who plead to multiple counts or are convicted of multiple counts of repeat property offender, you can often play with a sentence to give them a long enough sentence so they can get access to the AIP treatment programs. This does not address the people who are sentenced to the base rate 13-month repeat property offender sentence. For those people who receive that 13-month sentence, they are not able to get the benefit of the AIP programming, including intensive drug treatment and cognitive restructuring. My experience with this program has been that it's very successful, and I tried to think of a client who was a success story, who I could come and present to the committee, although I know that some of you have already heard testimony of those people. And, you know, I often don't get clients, you know, unless they're coming back because they've committed a new offense, I don't often speak with them after they're done at the Department of Corrections. But I was able to think of one client who was convicted actually of a crime that they'd be excluded under, but who was still successful. He wrote me a letter after he completed the AIP program, which he worked very diligently to get into with the Department of Corrections, and he is engaged, and he has finished college, and he owes a lot of that to being able to participate. His particular problems with alcohol and not drugs, but he was very happy with the program. He felt it put him on the right track, put him back in school, and helped him redirect his life from where it was going. I know that if he could be here today, he would absolutely fight tooth and nail for the expansion of this program. There are things that we like about this bill, there are things that we could live with about this bill, and there are things that we dislike very much about this bill. As far as what we like, even though this increases sentencing and we're in the same boat as Partnership for Safety and Justice, you very rarely hear us here in support of increasing sentences, but my practical experience and other lawyers and the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers' practical experience shows that these are people who need treatment and can't get it because of the short sentence. So we believe that it is appropriate to raise the sentence to 18 months, which would allow people access to that program. Second, we always support increased funding for treatment. We believe that it works. We believe Department of Corrections is doing an excellent job structuring this program, and there is a need for beds, and this would address that issue. The things we can live with are upping the second group of sentences and from 19 months to 27 months. We think it should be shorter, but I think this is a discussion for a later time. There's some things, like Mr. Sugarman said, that could be played with this bill that we don't like that could help address the revenue neutrality issue, and we hope the members of this committee will take the time, and I know you will, to look at these and do the hard work that is necessary to make this the good bill. One thing that hasn't been talked about, although Representative Bonamici addressed this issue, is that I think this would be an appropriate place to include community-based treatment options. And I know we're short on time, and I'll make this part very brief. But I think that if you can get these people before they reach the sentence that would send them to the Department of Corrections, you could save a lot of money and a lot of time and a lot of victims. And this would be an appropriate place to put a community-based treatment program that would address the people who are committing the predicate offenses to repeat property offender or who are being downward departed, as Mr. Miyabi talked about, out of repeat property offender. And what I envision, I've spoken with the panel who's worked on this bill, and they seem at least interested in talking about the issue, which I think is a good step, is taking these people and putting them in a residential treatment facility in the community before they get to the Department of Corrections, before they go to prison, and doing some of these same residential treatment programs that they would receive in AIP. I believe this would be a cost savings in the long run. I believe this would be a savings for victims and the savings for the community, and I hope the committee is willing to look at that as an option. Thank you for your time and energy. Thank you to the people who have worked on this bill. It really is good policy to increase AIP. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Alkanich. There are no questions for this panel. I'll excuse them. We have one more person signed up, Anna Peterson. Well, she's coming forward. It is my intention to open a public hearing on the next bill, then briefly before we have to go to the floor at 10:30, but I do want to hear from a couple of people who traveled here to present on House Bill 2532. So, Ms. Peterson, if you could wrap this up quickly here on House Bill 2329.
Thank you, Chair McPherson and committee. It is an honor to be here and a privilege. I'm a citizen. I'm a volunteer. I work almost full-time on the fight against methamphetamine. I chair the Governor's Meth Task Force. I'm a member of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. 4 years ago, I couldn't spell methamphetamine, but I learned that in my community, we were having a tremendous problem with property crimes and with neglected children, and that began the road to No Meth, Not in My Neighborhood and the Governor's Meth Task Force. I'm here today to tell you that the Governor's Meth Task Force, which was created just about 4 years ago, strongly supports treatment services. We, the task force, are made up of people from prevention, from enforcement, and from treatment. We've traveled a long road together educating one another about the importance of all three parts of that stool. All three legs of the stool must be present if we're going to win in the fight against methamphetamine and other drugs, illegal drugs. The importance of this bill, and particularly House Bill 2329, is because it does hold offenders accountable. It does provide some longer sentences. It also provides for treatment within the walls of the prison. I can't tell you how many people I've talked to who have been meth addicts, who are out, who are clean, who are successful in their lives because they had a chance when they were incarcerated, either in a jail or in prison, for treatment. And I know that treatment works. I've talked with people whose lives have turned around. I also visit jails and prisons when I get a chance. I also talk with people who are involved with drugs today. And the one thing that I learn again and again is that without treatment, none of the other services that can come for them, housing, employment, medical care, parenting services, none of those will work without the underlying treatment services. So I encourage your support for treatment services within the prison and certainly with the offender, the increase in some of the offender sentences so that that can occur. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Peterson. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2329 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2532. Is Representative Scott?
He's up.
Sure, he's on the way. On the way. I think that what I'll do, in the interest of time, as I mentioned before, this is the last bill we'll be able to hear today. Is going to be to hear from some witnesses who traveled here on House Bill 2532. So, with apologies to those who came on the other bills on the agenda, we will not be hearing House Bill 3371 or holding the work session on House Bill 3119.
We'll end that over until tomorrow.
We will roll both those bills over until tomorrow's agenda and hopes that we can proceed through our agenda more quickly than we did before. You certainly may, and I apologize for our not having gotten to it.
Thank you.
So, Council Taylor, why don't you give us the introductory remarks here on House Bill 2532.
Members of the Committee, House Bill 2532 comes to you from Representative Scott, prohibits a person from filing a petition for adoption of a child in a court if the child is a party to a juvenile court proceedings, requires juvenile court to notify all parties of juvenile court proceedings of the request for adoption in another court, allows the juvenile court to send to the court where the adoption petition is filed certified copies of the court records pertaining to the juvenile court in which the adoption petition is filed.
Thank you, Council. Since I don't see Representative Scott in the room, let's invite the three people who have signed up on this bill forward at the same time, Lee Eppinger, Pam Sorensen, and Shelley Digby.
Mr. Chairman of the Committee, the Dash 2 amendments are basically the bill.
Okay, the Dash 2 amendments are the Substance Committee, and since we don't have the benefit of, I see Representative Scott is coming into the room now, so maybe he could join you at the witness table. Representative Scott, are you could you pull a chair up here? We've got about 10 minutes before we have to be on the floor, and so we wanted to be able to hear from these good people without making them come back another day.
Great.
And Representative Scott, if you wanted to introduce this bill, since it's your bill, that would be fine for you to do.
We're on 2532.
2532. Unfortunately, we will not get to the other bill that was noticed for today, 3371. We just ran out of time.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Wayne Scott, State Representative, House District 39. House Bill 2532 is a bill that I introduced on behalf of a couple constituents from my district. Requires the juvenile court to transfer jurisdiction to another court to send certified copies of the court records of the proceedings pending to notify the parties of a transfer. And I'm here to testify on 2532 with the Dash 2 amendments. I introduced this legislation, as I told you earlier, on behalf of my constituents from Canby. They are here today and will briefly share their story as to why this simple bill is needed. 2532, as amended with the Dash 2, ensures the juvenile court judge, the court-appointed special advocate, and any interveners in a juvenile court case are notified before an adoption petition regarding a child in juvenile court jurisdiction can be filed in another jurisdiction. The bill is intended to fix a loophole in existing law which allows any adoption court to terminate a juvenile court case simply by entering an order of adoption. Currently, there's no requirements for the adoption court to contact the juvenile court regarding the adoption or even to be told that there is a juvenile court case in existence. This leaves us with a scenario where a juvenile judge can sign off on a finalization of an adoption of a child in its jurisdiction by another court, with no other information except the court has completed all their aspects of the adoption, all other aspects. There's no requirement that the juvenile judge be informed of the circumstances of the adoption or that the adoption judge be informed of the circumstances of the juvenile case. This situation raises the possibility of fraud, by any adoption petitioners with no system oversight to protect the child. When an adoption is entered without the CASA's or intervener's knowledge, they lose the opportunity to advocate for the child and to weigh in on the appropriateness of the adoption placement. House Bill 2532, as amended, is a simple fix that protects CASA's and intervener's ability to advocate for children and protects the children in our state from losing important safety protections. Pam Sorensen from the Marion County CASA is also here to testify in support of this bill. I'll be happy to take your questions, but Pam probably is much better able to answer any technical questions with that. The Dash 2 amendments are offered today because we learned the current version does not provide the safeguards that we had intended. So in closing, thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing House Bill 2532. Thank you, committee, for considering this bill, and I would appreciate if you would consider it with the Dash 2 amendments. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Scott. And let me just point out that in fact, that we've got about 4 minutes before we have to walk out to the floor, so use your time as you think is most effectively used with the remaining minutes we have left.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to thank you for your time today. I'll be really fast. I'm Pam Sorensen. I'm the director of the Marion County CASA program. This is Shelley Digby. She's a former foster parent. This is Lee Effinger. She's a court-appointed special advocate. The child in the case at issue was adopted out of Marion County jurisdiction. The child had been in juvenile court jurisdiction in Marion County. The gaps in the two laws that we're looking to fix, 109-309, which is the adoption petition, allows anyone to file an adoption petition without notifying the adoption court that the child at issue is in jurisdiction in a juvenile court proceeding. They don't need to notify them of that. We also want to fix, part of the gap is created by 419B328, which allows the termination of juvenile court wardship of a child by the simple order of adoption from any court that has competent jurisdiction. So juvenile court wardship of a child can terminate simply because an adoption is filed in another jurisdiction. At present, there's no requirement that the people filing for the adoption of the child notify the juvenile court that they're doing that. Nor does the juvenile court have to be notified of any of the circumstances of the adoption, with the simple exception of when the adoption is ready to be finalized. All aspects of the adoption are completed in the second jurisdiction. The juvenile court has to give authorization for the finalization of the adoption. Now, that does raise the issue, why doesn't the judge stop that? Well, if you've been in a juvenile court recently, you know that these judges hear 80 to 100 cases a day. And if the thing about the adoption file itself is it's totally separate and distinct from the juvenile court. So when the letter comes through asking for authorization on that consent, on that adoption, it comes from an attorney completely unrelated to the case, and it identifies the case only by case number and the surnames of the children. These juvenile judges hear, as I say, 80 to 100 cases a day. Any letter that comes across their desk asking for authorization of an adoption is probably going to be signed. However, by that point in time, the adoption court's already ruled on, and once this consent is issued for the adoption, then the children who are in juvenile court care, who are under the serious protection of the juvenile court justice system, are removed from that system because it's terminated by the entry of the adoption order, with no knowledge to the juvenile case of what's gone on in the adoption. The upshot of our case is that it was appealed, the juvenile case was appealed. The adoption court did agree to open an already closed adoption for the purpose of evaluating whether a consolidation between the two cases should happen, and that case continues on. So we continue to have Department of Human Services staff, we continue to have AGs on this case, and now it's pending in another court, and we did have an appeal filed as well. So this simple fix of requiring the juvenile court judge to consent to the filing of an adoption in another case, in another county, for a child in its jurisdiction will prevent this from happening and allow kids in juvenile court to maintain the protection of the juvenile court all the way through until the day they are adopted by an appropriate adoptive family. I would also like to point out in the juvenile case in Marion County, the sole issue at hand during the juvenile case when the adoption went through was whether or not this was an appropriate adoptive placement. And our belief is that if the juvenile court judge knew that the adoptive family was essentially court shopping and looking for an adoption order in another county, he would have used that information as yet more evidence that the adoptive family, who are now the legal parents of these children, were not the appropriate placement for them in the first place. So this, we recognize that this fix will not protect those kids from what we were afraid of in the first place, but it will prevent children in the future from being adopted out. The last thing that I wanted to point out that is really important, the adoption case, when the order is signed, is sealed. And the statute says that a court of competent jurisdiction can order an adoption order. You can't have competence if you have fraud. If you have a sealed file, you cannot prove fraud. So we don't know what was pled in the adoption case. We don't believe it was truthful, but the only way to find that out is to unreal all of that and to do a tremendous amount of legal work that costs 2 or 3 years of legal expenses, and at the same, while these children continue to live in this adoptive home.
Ms. Sorensen, we're out of time.
I know.
Thank you so much. I hope that there were other perspectives that needed to come from the other people at the...
Very good.
Well, thank you very much. And I'm sorry, folks, that you had to wait for a long hearing to get a fairly short time, but we did want to get you on since you had traveled to speak.
Mr. Chair, committee, please pass our bill.
Very good. Thank you very much. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2532. That concludes as much of our agenda as we can finish today, committee. Thank you very much. We're adjourned.